listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, we began on Tuesday reading from a book entitled Oklahoma City Day One by Michelle Marie Moore, and we will continue that today. But in the meantime, for those of you who have been listening and would like to get your hands on a copy of Oklahoma City Day One, you may do so by sending $34.95 to Harvest, H-A-R-V-E-S-T. Make check or money order payable to Harvest, and send it to Harvest, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's $34.95. Make check or money order payable to Harvest, and send it to Harvest in care of P.O. Box 1970, Eager, Arizona, 85925. If you live in the Eager Springerville area, you may obtain Oklahoma City Day One from Stewart Books on Main Street in Springerville. Ladies and gentlemen, Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 through 30. Another parable put he forth unto them, saying, The kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat, and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, Sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares? He said unto them, An enemy hath done this. The servants said unto him, Wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? But he said, Nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and in the time of harvest I will say to the reapers, Gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. those outside the building, everything was at a complete standstill. As we waited with great anxiety, C.A. Davis, who had been involved downtown with the rescue efforts, telephoned KFOR Channel 4 television to offer a report for the public. When asked if he could describe the scene inside the building, Mr. Davis said, "You just can't imagine it. There are bodies laying everywhere. There are people just laying there screaming, trying to get out. I've helped rescue several bodies. There were a bunch of babies that we've had to drag out. It's just a real gruesome sight. What they're trying to do right now is to search in there for another bomb. We're just trying to pull everybody who is a civilian back to a four-block radius. It's just a terrible sight. I'm a construction company owner, and I was coming down here to a trim company when the explosion happened. It rocked me pretty hard, and I didn't know what was going on. I went down there, and they asked me if I could take somebody to the hospital. I took four or five victims in my truck over to the Baptist Hospital, left there, and came back. I knew the maintenance man of the federal building. He was trying to help get blueprints to go down there and shut off the auxiliary power. We went down there, and the generators didn't kick off. The folks were afraid to get in the building because of all the live electrical. I just was trying to be a concerned person and help. I got deeper into it, and then things started falling on us. What we're trying to do now is to get some heavy cranes in here and try to get the bigger I-beams and concrete off these people and try to secure the area." As we waited, word came that a 2.5-year-old fair-skinned female child with red hair and blue eyes was being taken to Southwest Medical Center. Her condition was stable, but she needed surgery. She could not tell anyone her name, and no one could find her parents. Video footage of the child's wide-eyed, frightened face and tiny, clinging hands was broadcast as she was gently cradled and carried to an ambulance by a female volunteer. It was hoped that someone would recognize the child and contact the hospital or the parents. As the bomb squad continued to work in the Mirror Building, Dr. Thomas Coniglione, the medical director of St. Anthony Hospital, made an impromptu speech in front of the emergency entrance. He was very concerned about the delay in the rescue operation caused by the discovery of the secondary devices, and he offered his report to a public hungry for any information about the status of the injured who had been brought to his hospital. He looked tired and stressed as he spoke. "The situation at the present time is that we have treated more than 56 injuries. There have been several more since the last count. At the present time, the medical teams downtown are unable to get into the wreckage to retrieve more of the injured because of the presence of other bombs in the area. I've been told by the police department that just as soon as those bombs are defused, they will permit the medical teams to enter. Then once the medical teams enter, we expect quite a large number of rather badly injured individuals being brought here. We have an incredible capacity. I will tell you that of the 56 we've treated, each of the 56 injured individuals had a single doctor and at least one or two nurses with them. So we've had an amazing outpouring of support from the medical community. To have 56 doctors here at one time treating 56 patients is rather unheard of. We also right now have at least 3 or 4 other doctors who are just sitting here waiting for more of the injured to come. We have 3 patients in the operating room at the present time. We have more operating rooms ready to be used if needed. We don't have a problem with capacity. We do have a problem with a few too many volunteers. We've had volunteers coming from far out of town, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate them being here. Right now, I think we have all the doctors, nurses, and EMTs that we need. Concerning the number of injuries, the most that we've heard from the police department is that there are quite a number who are dead at the scene. There's another large number who are injured, but we have no absolute numbers. We've had 56. I think some of the other hospitals have had comparable numbers, so if you add that up, that's easily a couple of hundred injured. The initial group of injuries we saw were people who were on the street and outside, and they were injured by exploding glass. They had many superficial lacerations of the face, the scalp, and the back. There was one lady who had her hand on a doorknob when the explosion took place. The door flew open, and the power of the exploding door fractured the bones in her arm. She is currently in the operating room. Those are being fixed. So the initial injuries were people who were standers-by or visitors or walkers in the street. And then we started getting some children from the daycare center. And then we got some people from within the building. Those within the building were injured considerably worse than those who were out in the street. There are three people in the operating room right now. One has an injury to the carotid artery, which is the large artery in the neck. The other one has multiple injuries of the face and neck. The third one has injuries to his leg and the arteries supplying his leg. So these are rather substantial injuries. I had asked that some of the more critically injured people be brought here because of the physician supply we have here. We have many neurosurgeons, many orthopedic surgeons. They deal with the most severe injuries, so I've asked that those injuries be brought here. We're well equipped and well supplied with staff to take care of them. I do not know how they are being triaged from downtown, but I would think that we could handle any of the injuries because of our proximity and because of the enormous number of specialists we have. We've also set up a special area for all families. It is in the gymnasium of our mental health center. If any of the families go into the gymnasium, on the wall we have a huge board with names of everyone who has been injured and the hospital location of that individual. So it doesn't matter if that individual is here or elsewhere. Come here and you can find out where the individual is. And we also have conditions in a large number of these patients also. So we'd be delighted to be helpful, if we can, to anyone who wants to come to our mental health center. This was the first official report the public had received from any medical authority, and the news was not encouraging. By the end of the day, 12 hospitals would report treating bomb-related injuries. St. Anthony, Presbyterian Hospital, Baptist Medical Center, South Community Hospital, University Children's Hospital, Mercy Hospital, the Veterans Hospital, Deaconess, Hillcrest, and the hospitals in Bethany, Edmond, and Midwest City. At the time of Dr. Carniglione's report, approximately 200 individuals had been treated at area hospitals. By the end of the day, that number would exceed 500. 2 days later, when all of the numbers were finally tallied, it would be reported by the media that over 700 persons had been treated for bomb-related injuries at area hospitals and private clinics. During the lengthy statement by Dr. Carniglione, our attention had been focused on the people receiving medical treatment, the victims we all hoped and prayed would survive and recover. But then suddenly, an official report was released to the media from the governor's office. It was publicly confirmed that there were 8 dead, and 6 of them were children. We had just heard the first death count of many more to come over the next 16 days. Licensed practical nurse Lydia Winfrey reported that several of the children who had been removed from the building had had severe head injuries. One had been decapitated, and another had a hole in his head filled with plaster pieces. According to a local dentist working at the triage center on the south side of the Mira building, it appeared that the children had been hit in the face by the blast and had been blown backward toward the north side of the daycare center. The shocking description given was that their faces were blown off. Another witness described the bodies as sand blasted, as if they had been peeled. This was but one more indication that a bomb or bombs inside the building had exploded in addition to the bomb out on the street. Dolls and toys found near the young victims were brought out as possible aids to identification. Renewed waves of grief and shock swept through the community as this report became known. No one could have anticipated the number of fatalities that would ultimately be confirmed as a result of this horrible incident. We knew there had been a large number of people in the building at the time of the explosions, but we were also hearing of large numbers of injured who were being treated and released. That appeared to be a hopeful sign at the time, and people needed a hopeful sign. But things became progressively worse, and it soon seemed that there would be no end to this tragedy. The situation was grim. It was almost 11 o'clock in the morning, and of the possible 1,000 people believed to have been in the building, we knew the confirmed status of only 8. All we could do at that moment was wait and pray. The television news media then offered this report. The first bomb that was in the federal building did go off. It did the damage that you see right there. The second explosive was found and defused. The third explosive was found, and they are working on it right now as we speak. I understand that both the second and the third explosives were larger than the first. It is just incredible to think that there was that much heavy artillery somehow moved into the downtown Oklahoma City federal building. From what we were told in the last couple of live reports from downtown, they are starting to allow rescue and evacuation workers to move back closer to the building. So we would assume that they are doing so with some degree of certainty that there is some integrity and security around the building now. But both of the other devices that they found, of the 3 in all, the first went off. The other 2, we understand, were even larger than the first, and that is really almost too much for us to comprehend when you look at what that one bomb did to the front of the building. This was the first official media announcement that the bomb squad had indeed discovered additional explosive devices in the building. This report was repeated numerous times between 11 o'clock and noon. At the time these secondary device announcements were being made, they were simultaneously being confirmed by police and firefighters on the scene by way of local radio and scanner reports. But by mid-afternoon, the story had begun a transformation. By then, certain officials began saying that no other explosive devices had been found. The media followed suit and repeated what they were told. Something was very wrong with the way the story was taking shape, and it was particularly disturbing to observe that eyewitnesses were telling one story while officials, especially officials from Washington, D.C., who were not at the scene, were telling something completely different. It would be but a few more hours until all parties got coordinated, and then every local and federal source would tell every media representative that there was only one bomb, only one explosion, and that no secondary devices were found in the Mira building. They would stand uniformly by that story for 20 weeks. At the first official press conference, which was held in Oklahoma City at approximately 5 p.m. Wednesday afternoon, questions concerning secondary explosive devices were at first emphatically denied. Later, such questions were simply ignored. Public inquiries about secondary explosives were denigrated in the press, and anyone asking pertinent questions was automatically labeled a conspiracy nut. Several months later, however, an event occurred that changed the official story into something new and different. That event was the release of a 90-minute videotape made inside the perimeter by Technical Sergeant Melvin Sumter of the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Department. The 90-minute video released to independent investigators was a shortened version of many hours of video footage taken by Sumter for the Sheriff's Department and that he himself had edited. Even after editing, the visual information was damning indeed. When considering the contents of Sumter's videotape, it is important to recall that things that are similar are not necessarily identical, and a single point of dissimilarity disproves that they are identical. A brief 7-minute section of Sumter's videotape reveals firefighters removing weapons, ammunition, and explosives from the rubble of the building under the direction of federal law enforcement agents, with crowds of other workers observing nearby, including Sumter. An hour earlier in the videotape, Sumter's footage shows the 10:30 a.m. call for the evacuation of workers immediately following the discovery of other bombs in the building, the arrival of the bomb squad personnel, and the removal of rescuers from the area, including the evacuation of Sumter himself. What happened as a result of Sumter's videotape? And why is this a problem? The discovery of the canisters of fulminate of mercury was made by local rescue workers. The removal of the undetonated explosive devices from the building was executed by local bomb squad personnel after the majority of workers had been evacuated from the building and all people in the area had been moved back at least 4 blocks. The removal of these devices took place between approximately 10:30 a.m. and 11:15 a.m., a time of day in which, in daylight savings time, shadows are still west of any sunlit object. Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Call them, ask for the latest copy of the newsletter. Tell them that you're a steady listener to the Hour of the Time with William Cooper, and you will receive red carpet treatment, I guarantee it. Ask them how you can get your hands on some real money and do it now. 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. And if it's easier to remember, 1-800-BUY-COIN. That's 1-800-BUY-COIN. The removal of these devices took place between approximately 10:30 a.m. and 11:15 a.m., a time of day in which daylight saving time shadows are still west of any sunlit object. The latter 7-minute segment of weapons being removed shows no bomb squad personnel active on the scene. The weapons, ammunition, and explosives are being removed by firefighters under the direction of federal law enforcement agents. Many other workers are standing around waiting to be sent into action, and the shadows cast by the workers on the scene are indicative of a mid-afternoon time frame. One point of dissimilarity is enough to show that two events are not identical. These two similar events are not the same incident by any measurement. But there was a problem. When federal investigative agencies became aware of this videotaped evidence, they decided to tell the world that the two events were identical, then began to make public statements to the effect that the weapons, ammunition, and explosives removed from the Mura building during the afternoon by firefighters were the same explosive devices that had been removed by the bomb squad several hours earlier during the late morning. This was another bold-faced lie, but not many people were paying attention to the details. Many well-intentioned people fell for the government's specious explanation. The federal government had a particularly thorny problem on its hands. Too many witnesses knew for a certainty that multiple canisters of fulminate of mercury had been removed from the building by the bomb squad. Too many people were talking about how the government had been lying when it said that no other explosive devices had been found on the scene. Even the news media had a hard time swallowing the idea that after they had dutifully released all the official reports of discovered explosive devices based on solid eyewitness reports from the bomb site, those reports had been false because police and bomb squad personnel had, quote, made a mistake in their reports to the media, end quote. This one was not going to fly. Suddenly, after the feds had stood by their false official version for 5 months, they changed their minds. Now they were going to admit that explosives had been found in the building after all, but which explosives? When Sumter's videotaped evidence came to light, it became necessary to explain away that evidence somehow. The feds' explanation, preposterous though it was, confused the issue completely for most people. The government had no choice but to admit that the videotape did indeed show weapons, ammunition, and explosives being removed from the building. In addition, photographs had been released of arsenal rooms that had belonged to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobaccos, and Firearms. There was just no getting around these facts. The easiest way to handle this sticky situation was to make the public believe that the weapons, ammunition, and explosives that had belonged to the BATF were the same devices the bomb squad had removed during the morning. But they were not the same at all. When this video and photographic evidence forced its hand, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms finally had to admit that they indeed had arsenal rooms and that there had been weapons, ammunition, and explosives illegally stored in the Mura building. But the organization then stated that they weren't real explosives. They were all inert training devices. Amazingly enough, BATF spokesmen, both locally and in Washington, D.C., were able to repeat this story to the media while maintaining a straight face. No explanation was given about why the existence of these so-called training devices had been so vigorously denied for so long and acknowledged only when it could no longer be hidden from the public. No explanation was given about why, if the devices were totally inert and harmless, the BATF felt their presence in the building had to be concealed. No explanation was given to questions concerning the legality of storing weapons, ammunition, and explosives, inert or otherwise, in a federal building a mere 7 stories above the location of a daycare facility. No explanation was given for why federal law enforcement agents consistently lied to the media and the public about the weapons, ammunition, and explosives for 5 months following the bombing. And of course, nothing was ever said that would distinguish the removal of the BATF's materials during the afternoon by firefighters from the removal of the military's explosives materials during the morning by the bomb squad. With few exceptions, federal and local officials are still lying to this day about the secondary explosive devices found in the building during the first bomb scare at 10:30 a.m. on April the 19th, 1995. The somewhat sheepish admissions by the BATF merely serve as a smokescreen and should be seen for exactly what they are. The weapons, ammunition, and explosives stored by the BATF and removed by firefighters during the afternoon were not the canisters of fulminate of mercury or any other device removed by the bomb squad during the morning. There are clearly two different events under discussion here, and the media and federal agencies are doing their best to muddy the waters and confuse the public. There is a reason for this. Expert analysis detailed in Appendix C confirmed that small, carefully placed demolition charges had indeed been present in the building, and the disaster on the morning of April 19, 1995 was the result of a multi-phase plan. The bomb in the street served as the cover for the true cause of the massive destruction to the building, and the perpetrators of the street bomb had cooperated, possibly unknowingly, with other parties to bring about the most devastating terrorist act in American history. Even without the testimony of the experts, other evidence began to cast a sinister shadow over the entire federal investigation. Frightened eyewitnesses had privately come forward who had seen construction workers drilling and cutting cavities into the concrete support pillars at the second underground parking level days before the bombing. They had also overheard conversations between the alleged construction workers in which explosives and bombs were discussed and the relation of bombs to the size of the holes in the columns. No effort had been made by the workers to hide their activities, and it was not unusual to see construction workers in and around the Mura building. The workers did not appear suspicious to the witnesses, and it was believed at the time that the workers' comments were made in jest. It was only after the bombing that the significance of what had been observed struck home. In light of this information, it is clear that the bombing of the Mura building involved much more than a street bomb and some BATF weapons stored on the ninth floor. There were obviously many players in this tragic drama, but federal investigators decided to let the BATF take some of the heat rather than discuss fulminate of mercury or cavities cut into support pillars. It seemed to be a move of simple self-preservation. If agents or agencies of the federal government or the United States military or the National Security Council knew about the bombing plan, planned it themselves, or participated in the action, it would be absolutely necessary to conceal and or disguise that participation by any means possible. A perfectly utilitarian and extremely convenient explanation and excuse would be the presence of the huge arsenal of weapons and miscellaneous ordnance stored in the Mura building by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Because the BATF was still smarting from such bad press following the Waco massacre and the good old boys roundup scandal, and because it had become federal agency non grata in the eyes of the public, it was completely logical, plausible, and believable that this agency could have illegally stored weapons, ammunition, and explosives in the federal building that just happened to explode as a consequence of the detonation of the street bomb, thus causing the massive and asymmetrical damage to the building. This excuse, if believed, could successfully be used to disguise the involvement of any other person or agency in the bombing of the Mura building. The only problem with this scenario was that the BATF was not ready to serve as the sacrificial lamb and continued to assert that its explosives were only inert training devices. This arsenal room explosion hypothesis is one of the more popular conclusions touted by the underground press and by some independent investigators, but this is not what happened that April 19th. Investigative officials have yet to discover or admit that any of the stored ordnance detonated at any time, which could not have happened anyway had it been inert. But even if these munitions had detonated as a result of the force of the street bomb, this would not account for the second explosion, which occurred a full 5 to 8 seconds after the first, nor would it account for the presence of military canisters of fulminate of mercury in the Mura building. Nor would an explosion in the BATF arsenal room located on the 9th floor sever the concrete support columns at their bases or at the 3rd floor level, as much evidence also suggests. Suffice it to say that the hypothetical accidental detonation of BATF explosives cannot explain even a small portion of what happened that day. Yes, there were weapons, ammunition, and explosives illegally stored in the federal building. Yes, there was a BATF arsenal room on the 9th floor that had been ruptured by the initial blast. Of that, there is no doubt. But these matters were not the primary or even secondary cause of the devastation to the Mura Federal Building. Nevertheless, it must have seemed needful to federal officials that the public be swept away by this new BATF scandal, and in very subtle ways, information was regularly and intentionally leaked to lead independent investigators away from the truth. Of particular interest is the fact that even while officials have reluctantly admitted that BATF explosives were stored in the building, which would allow the hypotheses of a supplemental detonation to stand, even though its timing would be completely wrong, and even though the BATF claims the devices were inert, the feds have continued to deny that there was more than one explosion. It is also interesting to observe that when it became useful to cast blame in the direction of the BATF to disguise the real facts about the bombing and its perpetrators, more local officials became willing to offer information. This information must be carefully weighed because it is only partly true. These leaks serve as a deliberate distraction designed to satisfy the public's suspicions while completely sidestepping the issue of the second explosion, the fulminate of mercury, and the evidence of demolition charges inside the building's support columns. An example of this sudden willingness to tell all was provided by the self-proclaimed, quote, independent, end quote, investigator and possible damage control operative, John D. Cash, who inserted himself into the investigation in the role of a freelance writer conducting research for a book about the bombing. The timing of his entrance on the scene coincided with public complaints from several family members of deceased victims about the unsatisfactory explanations offered by federal officials. Understanding that no parasitic lie can exist without a modicum of truth on which to feed, one has to separate Cash's genuine discoveries of truth from his deliberate manufacture of misleading falsehoods. Cash skillfully used small bits of truth as bait, but reeled in his unsuspecting victims on a line of false conclusions. If you wish to gain the trust and respect of a group you intend to infiltrate, you must offer something substantive on which to build the relationship. This Cash did with great expertise, bamboozling most people who came in contact with him. Those persons never again questioned his sources, conclusions, contacts, background, means of support, or real purpose in the investigation. In this regard, the persons Cash was allegedly serving as an independent investigator were completely deceived. but it would be almost 6 months after the implosion of the Muir building before Cash would show his true colors. In the early stages of his independent investigation, Cash interviewed hundreds of witnesses, victims, and officials, including Dick Miller, the assistant fire marshal for the Oklahoma City Fire Marshal's office. Cash revealed the gist of his conversation with Miller in an interview with Chuck Allen. Mr. Cash said, quote, "Dick Miller, in very clear terms, readily admitted that there were explosives removed from the Muir building immediately after the disaster on the very same morning. And it was those devices that were removed from the Muir building which caused the evacuation of the rescue workers on at least three different occasions. It's important for people to understand that while they were in the process of removing these explosives, people were left bleeding to death and dying. This was a very real situation," end quote, so said John Cash. Now, what is wrong with Cash's account of Miller's testimony? The admission by Dick Miller is genuine. That he made the statement has been confirmed in independent interviews. However, the sentences following Miller's statement are Cash's misleading conclusions. The devices, quote, removed from the Muir building the very same morning, end quote, were not the materials stored by the BATF, and the BATF materials were not removed during the morning, as he implied in his next statement. Cash continued mixing fact with fantasy. I quote, "We have all heard the news story that came out from the BATF and the FBI that these explosives were nothing but training devices. This is the most absolutely ludicrous excuse. If anyone believes that, they are overlooking the very simple and obvious fact that experts went into that building. Experts removed police, fire, and civilian rescuers and moved them blocks away while they endeavored to remove all of these explosive devices. Dick Miller told me that the 10:30 a.m. bomb scare was related to a 2 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot box marked high explosives. In a subsequent interview with another reporter, Miller explained that he watched the bomb squad load that box up and haul it off. The box contained percussion caps that are used for C4, end quote. So said John Cash. It is certainly possible that such a box existed and might have been removed from the building. However, Miller's statement in this regard has not been confirmed from any source other than himself. No other testimony about the box marked high explosives has been forthcoming from any other worker at the bomb site. While no corroborating testimony supports the existence of Miller's box, three independent witnesses have confirmed the existence and removal of the military canisters of fulminate of mercury. Again, we are faced with the manufactured confusion concerning which explosives were removed when and by whom. Additionally, in the quotation above, Cash failed to identify the other reporter to whom Miller allegedly told his story. The most likely candidates for the other reporter are two gentlemen with whom Cash had many close dealings over many months and with whom he continues to associate: Arnold Hamilton of the Dallas Morning News and Lawrence W. Myers of Media Bypass Magazine. Neither of these gentlemen have come forward with this same story to confirm or deny Dick Miller's statements, and it is inconceivable that they would not do so if the statements were true and corroborated. If Miller intended that his statements be kept confidential, Cash violated that confidence by this disclosure. Remembering to always consider carefully the conclusions reached by Cash, one must look at the last statement in the earlier paragraph. Quote, "The box contained percussion caps that are used for C4, end quote. Cash does not say that Dick Miller made this comment, nor does he state that Miller revealed this information to the other reporter. We cannot confirm that the box existed, or if it did, that it contained anything. It is also extremely important to note that C4 is not activated by percussion caps, but rather by blasting caps or fuses. Percussion caps are used in the reloading of ammunition. when a percussive blow is struck against the percussion cap end of a bullet by the hammer of a firearm, the powder in the bullet explodes and the resulting gases force the bullet from the barrel of the gun. Blasting caps, on the other hand, are usually, but not always, activated electronically. Under no circumstances would a box of percussion caps, which are not in and of themselves considered ammunition, be labeled as high explosives, nor would a box of percussion caps be any threat at all, certainly not one requiring the presence of the bomb squad. The alleged presence of percussion caps in a box labeled high explosives makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And as an aside, ladies and gentlemen, anyone who knows anyone, or anyone who actually possesses reloading equipment and reloads their own ammunition in order to save money, if they really like to go to the range and practice with a firearm, or if they're engaged in the hobby of shooting, knows that percussion caps do not come in boxes labeled high explosives. They are not extremely dangerous. They can be purchased at any firearms or ammunition store here in Eager, Arizona. They can be purchased at Western Drug Store and carried out the door in a brown paper bag. And that's a fact. And now, back to the book. It is inconceivable, ladies and gentlemen, that a man as knowledgeable as Dick Miller would confuse percussion caps with blasting caps. Nor would he associate percussion caps with C4. Nor would he state that the bomb squad was required to remove a box of percussion caps from the Muir building. In this regard, it seems more likely that Cash has again reached a false conclusion, or has purposely created a red herring with his comments about the contents of the alleged box.
Thank you.
This is the voice of freedom. Freedom Radio Network, with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the country and around the world. The Hour of the Time is also carried on WRMI, Worldwide Shortwave Radio, 9955 kilohertz, from 5 until 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to a reading of Oklahoma City Day One, written by Michelle Marie Moore. If you would like to purchase a copy of Oklahoma City Day One, and we highly recommend that you not only purchase a copy for yourself, but several copies, if you can afford it, to give away as gifts and to make sure that important people in your community and in your state, whom you feel might be able to help us restore constitutional Republican government and reveal the truth about what happened in Oklahoma City on April the 19th, 1995. If you feel that these people can help, purchase a copy of the book and make sure that it gets into their hands. It is absolutely imperative, ladies and gentlemen, that the truth reach the American people. There is massive historical precedent for creating disasters to manipulate public opinion and to perform social engineering. And if you read the history of socialism and communism, it is right there in front of your eyes. And they weren't the ones who invented it. It goes back over 2,000 years. It was used by Cicero in the old Roman Republic to destroy the constitution of the Roman Republic, create an oligarchy, and then, of course, as we all know, a dictatorship. The Roman Empire went down in a wave of socialism where everybody was sucking off the empire, but nobody was contributing anything. If you don't want that to happen to the United States of America, you must help us. Purchase a copy of this book. Read it. Call your local bookstores. In fact, you can help us get this into bookstores all across America if you will just call all the bookstores in your area Ask them if they have Oklahoma City Day One. Tell them you'd like to purchase a copy. And it's too bad that they don't have it, because that means you'll have to go somewhere else to get it. And pretty soon, maybe they will get the hint and start stocking their shelves with this book. But if you'd like to get one right now, in the meantime, send $34.95 postpaid. This is a very heavy book. It weighs over 2 pounds, ladies and gentlemen, 640 pages. An extensive appendix, a complete index, a complete bibliography. Everything is documented and sourced, and nothing in this book is in here that does not come from at least two or more independent sources that have absolutely nothing to do with each other. That is one of the basic criteria of our investigations. $34.95, ladies and gentlemen, postpaid. Make your check or money order payable to Harvest, and send it to Harvest, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, Arizona, 85925. That's $34.95 postpaid. Make your check or money order payable to Harvest, and send it to Harvest, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. And if you live in the Eager Springerville area, you can save $5 by picking up your copy at Stewart Books on Main Street in Springerville. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Continuing with Cash's interview,
He launched into the BATF arsenal room hypothesis. I quote, "I had speculated early on that the BATF, the Secret Service, and the DEA were most likely storing explosives illegally in the building in their arsenal rooms. Sure enough, as time went by, witnesses came forward, and we now have videotapes of the workers removing all kinds of ordnance from the ruins of the building on the day of April 19th, referring to the Sumter videotape. I have discovered that indeed the DEA and the BATF had arsenal rooms on the ninth floor. I have obtained photographs of the BATF arsenal room. I have four different live witnesses on tape who have said that they watched the BATF unload their arsenal room 2 weeks after the blast. They helped them load different devices and firearms, every firearm known to man. There were hundreds of thousands of rounds of ammunition, explosives, boxes marked explosives, tow missiles, hand grenades. Just about everything short of a T-72 Russian tank was in that building. But the most important thing is that they were storing devices that were high explosives, which definitely did not belong in a public building," end quote. Now, a sharp, knowledgeable person might have caught every misleading statement in Cash's account and discerned truth from fiction. The fact remains that no matter what the BATF or any other federal agency might have been storing in the Miro building, those devices were not the canisters of fulminate of mercury removed from the building during the 10:30 a.m. evacuation, nor were they the cause of the secondary explosions, nor did they sever support columns, all of which we know did occur. The fact that the BATF kept an arsenal answers none of the real questions in this situation, and the implications are not lost on a public that was reeling emotionally from the slaughter of innocent children. Cash's account served mainly to alter and color the perceptions of that public. Additionally, his alleged witnesses who watched the unloading of the BATF arsenal room 2 weeks after the explosions were obviously not referring to the materials removed on the afternoon of April 19th, are the military materials removed that morning. The real intent and thrust of Cash's statements are summed up in his own words. Quote, "The most important thing is that they, the BATF, were storing devices that were high explosives which definitely did not belong in a public building," end quote. The most important thing to whom? What high explosives? Cash has a very real problem here with the truth. If the BATF materials were harmless and inert, then those materials did not contribute in any way to the destruction of the building or to the deaths of the victims. If the BATF's materials were not inert, there is still no evidence that any of its materials detonated at any time. If they had, there would have been little material to remove 2 weeks later, and thus neither contributed to nor caused the devastation. If the BATF's materials were not inert, and if any evidence existed that the rupture of the ninth floor arsenal room resulted in a supplemental explosion, the location of that explosion would still not account for the column collapses in the building. And if such a thing occurred, the government would have to admit that there had been secondary explosions on April 19th. This they have not done. It must be understood that the actions of the BATF were certainly deplorable, and the storage of the weapons, ammunition, and explosives in the Mira building was definitely a violation of law. These things should vigorously be exposed and condemned. But these situations and conditions do not in any way explain what occurred that morning. The focus on the BATF's arsenal is a deliberately manipulated distraction designed to turn our attention away from much more serious and certainly more factual evidence. Cash has been a key player in promoting the BATF arsenal explosion hypotheses, and in this regard, he has led many good and well-intentioned people sadly astray. Many have fallen for his stories because the stories are based in fact, but the conclusions drawn from those facts are pure fiction. Regrettably, two of the people most intensely involved in the independent investigations into the bombing, Glenn Wilburn and State Representative Charles Key, have both fallen prey to Cash's performance. Because of Cash's influence on these two respectable gentlemen, the evidence and conclusions offered by Wilburn and Key must also be carefully weighed in order to separate the truth from the deceptions perpetrated by Cash. Glenn Wilburn, the grandfather of two small children killed in the daycare center, raises many issues in his own investigation of the bombing. Wilburn said, quote, "I've got a lot of questions about it. I also have questions about explosives in the building. I have talked to an investigator who has taped interviews with civilian employees who worked in the building, taped almost immediately after the blast. And they tell of explosives that the BATF had stored in that building and that were carried out by BATF several times in the days following the explosions," end quote. The investigator of whom Mr. Wilburn spoke was none other than John D. Cash. If BATF explosives were stored illegally in the Muir building, it is unlikely that civilian employees would be knowledgeable of that fact unless they were employed by the BATF, in which case their testimony almost immediately after the blast is even more unlikely. And of course, if the explosives were carried from the building by the BATF in the days following the explosions, they were not the devices removed by the bomb squad at 10:30 a.m. on April the 19th. Wilburn continued, "We've been told that the first bomb scare was not, in fact, a bomb scare, but was designed to get the civilians and all personnel back. Then the BATF went in there to get their files and also to take explosives out, which they had illegally stored, as well as munitions from the ninth floor. If that's true, we've got a serious problem because we have explosives being stored illegally in a public federal building." Now, some of Wilburn's testimony and suppositions here are inaccurate. The first bomb scare absolutely was a real bomb scare. There's nothing phony or laughable about fulminate of mercury with detonators attached. According to Nurse Tony Garrett, those devices were equipped with a timer set to detonate 10 minutes after the first explosion, at the very time when a large number of rescuers would have arrived on the scene to assist the injured. The canisters of fulminate of mercury were military devices, not BATF arsenal weapons, nor were they Cash's alleged percussion caps or C4. As for the remainder of Wilburn's statement, additional investigation did confirm that the BATF did go back into the building to recover files and stored ordnance. But the BATF was not the only federal agency to do so. Although we did not realize it on the day of the explosions, it was later revealed that several distinct and separate agendas were being followed while the world thought the emphasis of all operations was to rescue the living and remove the dead. Robin Jones, general manager of KQCV KNTL Radio, uncovered similar information. In her well-researched book, Where Was God at 9:02 a.m., Jones wrote, "The Secret Service, ATF, FBI, DEA, and U.S. Marshals, all housed in the building, rushed their own investigators and agents to the scene, partly to help with the rescue effort, partly to recover sensitive material." Ms. Jones interviewed an eyewitness who stated, "Three distinctly different operations were going on. FBI and Secret Service people were searching through file cabinets in the rubble for sensitive information. Everything, every ongoing investigation, every undercover agent was barred to the world in that rubble. They had to get it. The ATF and FBI and others were also investigating the bombing itself, and the third was the rescue operation." Dick Miller's information and the testimony of the witnesses mentioned by Cash, Wilburn, and Jones make for a very good story, almost too good and almost too convenient. But while it all casts a very embarrassing light on possible illegal activities of the BATF and other government agencies, it offers nothing to explain other more compelling evidence that indicates what may really have occurred on the morning of April the 19th. there was much more going on than was readily apparent, and much more happened that day that has not yet been revealed. It is this much more that officials are still frantically attempting to conceal. Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. wrote in 1858 in The Autocrat of the Breakfast Table, and I quote, "You never need think you can turn over any old falsehood without a terrible squirming and scattering of the horrid little population that dwells under it," end quote. And then came the birth of the official story. The all clear sounded shortly before 11 o'clock in the morning. Bomb squad officers left the scene, and the waiting firefighters, medical personnel, and civilian rescuers quickly filed back into the remains of the Muir building. Firemen had earlier reported finding survivors to whom they had been speaking through the cracks in the concrete floors, and they were anxious and impatient to return to work. Said one medical worker as she hurried back into the bomb site, "The debris you see laying out in the street in piles and stuff, it's exactly like that in the building. It's dark and it's dusty. There are bodies and there's chaos everywhere." An Oklahoma City police officer, angered by the senseless horror of the scene, spoke with great frustration to the news media. "You wonder how somebody could be so heartless. We're not talking about only adults' lives, but also children. There was no compassion for anybody. This is just a cold-blooded killing." A few minutes before the all-clear was announced, Governor Frank Keating ordered all state employees to go home for the day. The state legislature had recessed at about 10 o'clock, and public hearings at the Corporation Commission headquarters at the Jim Thorpe building just southwest of the Capitol were interrupted by evacuation orders. Prior to leaving the buildings in the Capitol complex, employees were asked to check their offices for anything unusual that they might not have seen before. They were also warned not to touch any strange object, but to immediately notify the security guards. As a precaution, Capitol police officers began systematically searching the state capitol and the surrounding government buildings floor by floor. All buildings in the complex were evacuated, and all entrances to the Capitol building were closed except one. The entrance that remained open was heavily guarded by Capitol police. Following the evacuation, explosives experts from the Oklahoma Highway Patrol, the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Department, Fort Sill Army Base, and Tinker Air Force Base swept the Capitol area in search of bombs. Later that afternoon, dogs trained to sniff out explosives were brought in to complete the sweep. Their first stop, the governor's office. No explosives were reported found. The Oklahoma County Courthouse was also evacuated with instructions that regular court business would resume the next day, but all jurors were excused from duty until the secured area became accessible. In downtown Oklahoma City, the blast had forced the closing and evacuation of the Federal Reserve Bank, located at 226 Dean A. McGee. Most of the bank's windows had been blown in, and about 200 employees were sent home for the day. Three other downtown banks, Bank of Oklahoma, Bank First, and Citibank, closed for the day because of damage to the buildings and their inaccessibility due to the roadblocks. Only essential personnel remained on duty at Boatman's First National Bank of Oklahoma and Liberty Bank and Trust. Employees were instructed not to come to work the next day unless they were contacted by their supervisors. The general guideline was, if you don't get a telephone call, stay home. As the Oklahoma State Capitol Complex and downtown businesses were being evacuated, we learned that in many other areas of the country, federal buildings were being cleared of workers. Evacuations were ordered in some instances, and security was intensified at the IRS building in Boston, Massachusetts, and at the federal buildings in Fort Worth, Texas, Omaha, Nebraska, Wilmington, Delaware, Detroit, Michigan, Boise, Idaho, Portland, Oregon, Des Moines, Iowa, Indianapolis, Indiana, St. Louis, Missouri, Greenville, Tennessee, Cincinnati, Dayton, and Steubenville, Ohio, East Palo Alto, Riverside, and Santa Ana, California, and throughout the state of New York. Security was increased generally at federal buildings in New Mexico and Washington State and at the U.S. Capitol and the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. Copycat bomb threats were causing great alarm throughout the United States. Law enforcement officials and terrorism experts tried to calm the public, said Professor James Fox of Northeastern University, also an investigator into the World Trade Center bombing. Despite the fact that we hear of these events and they make major headlines, it's still a rare event, and we should not be paranoid into thinking that we are constantly at risk. Other similar announcements did little to settle the rising fear in the nation. After the news of the bombing spread across the country, U.S. deputy marshals in Denver, Colorado, were seen guarding the federal building and the U.S. courthouse in that city with shotguns and automatic rifles. Armed guards were also posted at daycare centers for federal employees in Denver, Colorado, and in Ogden, Utah. The whole country seemed to be on alert because of the Oklahoma City disaster, not knowing if it was an isolated incident or the first of a series of orchestrated attacks. In the meantime, however, rescue workers at the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building faced a new problem. Cellular phone frequencies were jammed by the heavy calling traffic, and police and medical personnel were finding it very difficult to manage their interagency communications. Southwestern Bell Telephone Company evacuated 918 employees from its operations in five major downtown buildings, but maintained enough technical staff to set up emergency communication systems at the bomb site. Spokesman Tom Hunter said, "Because of the heavy telephone calling traffic, we have done some selected call blocking to keep the system from being overloaded to a crisis point." However, he assured the public, no 911 calls have been blocked. Bell's parking lot at 800 North Harvey was quickly transformed into the central command location for federal investigators and the Oklahoma National Guard, and emergency landline phone banks were set up in two locations for use by emergency personnel. The Cellular One company then provided 225 cellular phones and free cellular service to emergency services personnel to ease communication problems. Radio and television stations made urgent pleas to the general public to stay off all telephone lines to help clear the communication jam. Shortly after 11 o'clock, Mayor Ron Norick granted a curbside interview to the press. He was the first official to make a public statement revealing the embryonic version of what would later become the official bomb story, as it would be told by federal law enforcement agencies and, consequently, the media. This story would eventually go through many alterations, adaptations, and transformations, but at this early hour, the tale was just beginning. It was during Mayor Norick's initial street interview that we learned that the official story was going to center around a single vehicle loaded with explosives. The official version of this vehicle would change style, color, make, and size, and the size of the bomb would also grow dramatically in the week that followed. But in its first telling, as the rescue workers were re-entering the federal building after the first bomb scare, this was the mayor's report. Quote, "There are no theories at this point," Mayor Norick said, "only speculations. Obviously, it was a bomb, a car bomb. It was a very large device. Why, we can't imagine. But there's a lot of injury and there's a lot of death, and we've got to get the people out. There are still a lot of people in the building." When asked where the search for the other bombs had been concentrated during the bomb scare at 10:30, Mayor Norick, gesturing broadly toward the Mura building, replied, "Well, in that whole area, it's anywhere in that area. If this is a car bomb, it could be anywhere. They've got dogs, so they're checking it out. They're probably the best way to find devices that they're, and they're using them extensively." The mayor was questioned about the location of the alleged car bomb at the time of the explosion and was asked how he knew where it had been parked. "We know where it was parked from the police department and from other people on site," said Norick. "It left about an 8-foot crater. You can see where the car was. At first they thought it was in the parking garage, but apparently it was a car bomb on the street. It blew a crater about 8 feet deep in the street and melted a couple of cars together. They'll let you all in there eventually and you can take a look at it." But the mayor spoke too soon. No media personnel would ever be allowed into the perimeter to inspect the crater at any time. As previously mentioned, the crater was deliberately filled prior to the inspection made by representatives of defense attorney Stephen Jones and his independent investigators. No one other than federal officials was ever allowed investigative access to that portion of the bomb site. As the mayor's speech ended, KFOR television Channel 4 news anchor Kevin Ogle began reading an AP news release directly from the newswire. He announced, quote, "Other explosives were put into cars that were driven into the parking garage," end quote. But before he could finish reading the statement, he was sharply cut off by his co-anchor, Devin Skillion, who suddenly changed the subject, and nothing more was ever said about this at any time on any network by any newscaster. That brief and truncated announcement was the only information ever released by the media that began to address the issue of explosives cutting the support columns in the building. From this point forward, the severing of the columns would never be addressed by the media or any federal officials. It was an issue that would be completely ignored. I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to The Hour of the Time, brought to you by Swiss America Trading. They're our people in Phoenix who specialize in non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets. Real money, a commodity that has intrinsic value in and of itself, which is what money must have in order to be money. Many of you have noticed that over the years we've gone from a nation where the head of the household was able to hold down one job and support a middle-class family of five pretty well, until today, where it takes almost everybody in the family who can work to bring in enough money to barely meet all the bills and obligations And so everyone is constantly on the verge of bankruptcy all the time. And it is indeed distressing. There's no one to stay home and take care of minor children who must now go to government-controlled daycare centers where they are taught how to live in a one-world environment. The Constitution is not taught in our schools anymore, or at least not in most of our schools. There are some holdouts, but not many. Most of us, if we were to lose one of the jobs that keeps the family afloat, would have about 1 or 2 months until they would have to sell their home and their possessions in order to feed themselves and stay alive. Most Americans today, if they were to liquidate all of their possessions, sell everything and pay off all the loans and debts that they owe, might have, if they were lucky, as much as $2,500 left to their name after all those years of work and drudgery and trying to accumulate some kind of a future for themselves. How did this happen? It happened, ladies and gentlemen, because of the money that you are using that has nothing of real value behind it. In fact, it has nothing behind it whatsoever. It represents nothing other than somebody owes somebody else some money. And the quickest way to figure that out is put down a $1 bill next to a $100 bill and tell me the difference between the two. What makes the $100 bill worth $100 and the $1 bill worth a dollar? You see, the value is in your mind, and any time the value is in your mind, it is a fantasy, and sooner or later, it must all come tumbling down. This country is no longer operating under the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution for the United States of America and the Bill of Rights and the amendments thereto. And the quickest way to discover that, ladies and gentlemen, is go directly to the Constitution and read it and figure out what is constitutional money. It says that no state shall tender in payment of debt anything other than gold or silver coin. It also gives Congress the power to coin money, not print money, not farm it out for somebody else to create by making a bookkeeping entry and giving you some credit so that you can use it to destroy yourselves and this country, but coin money. And the law itself defines a dollar as a specific weight in measurement and of purity of silver coin. You see, a Federal Reserve note can no more be a dollar than a quart can be milk. For the dollar is the unit of measurement, just like a quart is a unit of measurement for milk. You can have all the quarts you want, but without the milk inside, you do not have milk. And you can have all the Federal Reserve notes that you want, but without that specific weight and measurement of purity of silver coin behind it, you do not have a bit of money. You've been fooled. We are a nation of fools today. We're going to have to wake up real quick. Call Swiss America Trading. Get your hands on some real money. 1-800-289-2646. And do it now, folks. Don't procrastinate. You know how you are. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-BUY-COIN. Channel 4 newscast abruptly cut downtown to reporter Gina Davis, who quoted a statement made by Oklahoma City Assistant Fire Chief John Hansen, whereby another element was added to the official story. Said Ms. Davis, "John Hansen just told me that the blast was so tremendous that a crankshaft was blown a half a block away." A vehicle part would later become key evidence that would point an accusing finger at the three men ultimately indicted in the bombing. But exactly which automotive part was going to be responsible for the investigative breakthrough had not yet been solidly established in the official story. Over the days that followed, this vehicle part would be described by different eyewitnesses as a crankshaft, an axle, a differential, a rear transaxle gear, a rear bumper, and a piece of the frame. It seemed that every automotive part discovered in the area had to be a portion of the bomb vehicle. Few seemed to consider that there were over 600 vehicles destroyed in the immediate vicinity of the Muir building, and many more outside that location. And auto parts of every size and description were scattered over a quarter-mile area around the building. It took federal officials a little time to determine which automotive part of many was the part that held the investigative key. But once they made up their minds and to juggle things a bit at the scene, the axle story became etched in stone. The suspicious automotive part was seen in at least four different locations, ranging in distance from a half block to two blocks from the Muir building, both east and west of the bomb site. The actual evidence-bearing part, the actual location of the part, and the real identity of the witnesses who allegedly found the part have remained the subject of much controversy among people who have continued to track the inconsistencies of the federal investigation. The crankshaft mentioned by John Hansen was located a half block to the northwest of the building. Governor Frank Keating claims to have found a suspicious axle two blocks due east of the Muir building. He later claimed to have found his suspicious axle one block away, so his previous find might have walked a little closer to town. A police source who spoke on condition of anonymity said FBI agents had found an axle of a van believed to have carried the bomb about two blocks northeast of the scene. KFOR news anchor Sean McLaughlin described a different axle as video footage of mangled metal was televised. "You are looking at an axle sticking out. From what we are told, that axle belonged on the car which the explosives were in, and the force of that explosion literally lodged that axle into another car, fused it, and melted it into another car." ABC national media representatives spoke of the discovery of an axle that might have come from a brown one-ton pickup truck and described very molten truck parts located two blocks from the scene. Finally, in a televised interview, a local police officer laid claim to Keating's mysterious axle and stated that he was the person who had actually found it one block northeast of the building. It was never clear which of the four axles seen and described was the real bomb vehicle axle. Architectural design team coordinator James Loftus reported that he saw the differential of the bomb vehicle approximately 500 feet to the west of the Muir building in front of the Regency Tower apartments, and stated that he was told by law enforcement officials that it was from the bomb car. James L. Pate, a writer for Soldier of Fortune, claimed to have seen the rear transaxle gear from the bomb vehicle smashed into a fence located one block northeast of the building. Richard Sherrill, reporter for Soldier of Fortune magazine, found a rear bumper of a Ryder truck 2.5 blocks from the blast site. The initial examination of the bumper seemed to indicate that the truck may have been a Ford Model EC-350. It was with great sensation of deja vu that we learned, once the axle was named as the official bomb vehicle identifying part, that the mysterious axle just happened to have the vehicle identification number on it, just like the mysterious axle discovered in the World Trade Center bombing. In spite of the fact that the many suspicious automotive parts came from a car, a van, a pickup truck, a half-ton truck, a one-ton truck, and a large truck, they were all supposed to be from the bomb vehicle. And this situation was going to take some serious sorting and juggling. At approximately 11:15 a.m., Governor Frank Keating telephoned President Bill Clinton to seek further help and ask for an emergency declaration. The governor also requested that federal investigative and rescue workers be sent to Oklahoma City. President Clinton stated that he would send the exact same team that had investigated the World Trade Center bombing in 1993 to assist in the Oklahoma City situation. Members of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, were activated on a regional level and dispatched by the FBI because of the perceived potential for more problems in the area. Immediately following these announcements, the Associated Press Newswire carried this statement from Washington, D.C. Quote, "The head of the BATF now says that it appears it was a car bomb with as much as 1,200 pounds of explosives packed inside," end quote. Here was another piece of the official story. The 1,200 pounds of explosives. This figure would increase greatly over the days to come as federal officials found it necessary to make certain that the proposed bomb was large enough to have caused such damage. Initially, it was reported that the bomb contained 1,200 pounds of explosives. Later, this figure increased to become an indefinite couple of thousand pounds, followed by several thousand pounds, and finally expanded into 4,800 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer and fuel oil. No one ever explained this remarkable growth spurt. As the size of the bomb increased, the suspected transporting vehicle also had to increase in size, which it did. The growth of the street bomb was halted only when the by then officially designated bomb vehicle had reached the limits of its cargo capacity. Initially, it was reported that the bomb-bearing vehicle was simply an automobile. Later, Police Sergeant Kim Hughes reported that the bomb had been carried in a blue National car rental minivan with Texas license plates. By Thursday, the news media was reporting that the bomb had been brought into Oklahoma City in a mid-sized, half-ton, Yellow Rider rental truck, the rental agency of terrorists, it seems. And I added that last little association because we were told that it was a Rider rental truck used in the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York City. The Rider rental truck eventually became a 20-foot cargo carrier. This final version of the truck was large enough to accommodate the alleged 4,800 pounds of ammonium nitrate fertilizer and fuel oil, which just happened to be the largest Rider truck available to the suspects on the day that the truck was supposed to have been rented. At this point, the bomb and vehicle statistics were finally settled by the feds. Remarkably, the Rider rental company seemed to have become the agency of choice among terrorists. Both the World Trade Center bomb and the Oklahoma City bomb had supposedly been transported in Rider vehicles. It was later revealed that both the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms had long-standing user arrangements with Rider Systems Incorporated. Ironically, in the weeks that followed, the bomb site area was inundated with Yellow Rider rental trucks used by federal agencies in the removal of equipment and materials from the former Mura building. Also of note was the fact that Mitchell Anthony Burns, chairman, president, and CEO of Rider Systems Incorporated, was listed on the membership roster of the Club of 300 of the Trilateral Commission. That particular roster was publicly released April 15, 1995, and was published in its entirety in Veritas newspaper on June 5, 1995. Copies of the roster can be obtained by written request addressed to the Trilateral Commission, N.A., 345 East 46th Street, Suite 711, New York, New York, 10017. At 11:30 on the morning of the blast, the official story was still in its infancy. We were told that a car bomb containing 1,200 pounds of explosives had blown up in the street in front of the Mira building, and that the important automotive evidence at that time was a crankshaft found one half block to the west of the site of the explosion, located in front of the Regency Tower Apartments. And that's where we're going to halt today's reading, ladies and gentlemen. As you can see, the evidence of deception is overwhelming. And I mean overwhelming. No reasonable, intelligent person could examine the evidence and reach any other conclusion that the government is covering up extensively its own involvement in the explosion of the Alfred P. Mira Federal Building on April 19, 1995, and that it has altered the evidence, has continuously and habitually lied to the American public, and that the news media appears to be in collusion with these lies. And that may be because the national media basically gets all of its news from one or two sources, Associated Press and UPI, United Press International. So when you say, well, all of them can't be lying, you are probably right. Just the source of where they get their news. You see, almost all of the news that you hear in this country comes from one source, and that's the Associated Press. So if the Associated Press is lying, what you get is lies from everybody. And that's why when you turn from ABC to NBC to CBS to CNN, you hear the exact same stories in the exact same words with the exact same pictures and videotape to support them. Even though all of these news media are supposed to be independent of each other, and they are supposed to be telling you the truth, they don't even know what the truth is, ladies and gentlemen. But if they did, you can be assured they would still support the lies of the agencies of the federal government, because they are all working toward the same goal. That is to bring down this country in a wave of socialism. If you don't believe that, investigate it for yourself. Stick around. You'll find out. If you've been listening to this broadcast for the last 4.5 years, you have a list of documentation as long as Main Street that proves it. Just as we documented Oklahoma City Day 1 in our investigation of the bombing of the Alfred P. Mira Federal Building in Oklahoma City on April 19, 1995, so we have documented everything that we have given you from the inception of this broadcast almost 5 years ago. For those of you who would like to obtain a copy of Oklahoma City Day 1, you may do so by sending $34.95 postpaid, make check or money order payable to Harvest, and send it to Harvest, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. That's Harvest, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, Arizona, 85925. That's $34.95. That is the price of the book, plus all postage and handling fees. And they are expensive because this book weighs over 2 pounds, ladies and gentlemen. It's 640 pages in length. It includes an extensive appendix, completely documented and sourced, a complete index, a complete bibliography. There is no supposition, there is no rumor, there is no opinion in this book. It is all proven fact. And it is laid out in such a manner that you also can seek out and discover the documentation for yourself so that you will know that we have not presented you with any falsity whatsoever. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, to stay tuned later tonight for the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network's presentation of the Jackie Patru program at 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 Mountain, 8 Central, and 9 Eastern Standard Time. Until then, good night, and God bless each and every single one of you, and may God save this republic. This is the Voice of Freedom. worldwide Freedom Radio Network, with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 FM stations across the nation and around the world. The Hour of the Time is also broadcast on WRMI, International Shortwave, 9955 kilohertz, from 5 until 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Monday through Friday nights. We now return you to All Oldies, Most of the Time.
A fine romance, my good friend.